You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. You're watching Culturally Determined, and I'm your host, Arya Cohen-Wade. And my guest today is Kirby Ferguson. Kirby, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Kirby Ferguson. I am a filmmaker, speaker, and writer, and I'm based in Portland, Oregon.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. You've actually been on Blogging Heads one time before, talking to Bob Wright.
Yeah.
Around four or five years ago, I think.
Yeah.
And, let's launch into it by talking about the Kickstarter, which is what made me want to have this conversation with you as soon as possible. So you have a Kickstarter up. It's related to the project that kind of brought you to internet attention, national attention,
mm-hmm.
which I really enjoy, which is called Everything is a Remix.
Yeah.
And... Do you want to talk about the new project and the new video and how that works into the Kickstarter you're doing?
Yeah, I'll talk about there was a Kickstarter before this where we just wanted to print some shirts. That's all we started with. We set a goal of $1,000 because the fifth year anniversary of Everything is Remix was coming up. The fifth year since it began, not since it ended, but since it started. So we thought, t-shirts were just always on, I sold them briefly for a little bit, but basically there's something that people asked about, frequently and it just never had happened. So we decided to do a little campaign just to make t-shirts and we would promote that with, a remastered version of Everything is a Remix, which I also is one of those things that was just sort of kicking around for a long time because there were a few mistakes in the video that I wanted to fix. And also the first part just got made to a different standard than the parts after it got made. It got made pretty quickly.
Right. And you released these for free originally.
Yeah, that's right. So Everything is Remix was a four-part video series that ran from 2010 to 2012. And we'll
provide links to the Kickstarter and the original stuff and everything else we mentioned. Links will be below. But it's a very entertaining kind of short video series pointing out that everything in culture is... borrowed, stolen from something else that came earlier in human culture.
Yeah, that's the basic premise of it. So it came out in a period when I feel like that idea has kind of been absorbed by the cult. I certainly wasn't the only person making the argument, but that idea is kind of absorbed into at least nerd culture that idea is out there. But it was less known back when I started the series. So yeah, it's just the idea that your ideas can never completely be yours.
I believe it was Shakespeare who said there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a very
Shakespeare, every single plot of single play is
recycled,
just a ripoff of from another
of Star Wars.
Well, the Tempest, I think.
Right.
Is original, but like everything else is, Hamlet, there was
right.
Hamlet, like everything else.
Sure, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very, very old idea. So I just popularized it and made it pop cultural and technological and media centric, basically. Mm-hmm. So that was a very popular series back in the day. And, I wanted to tidy it up a bit and put it back and fix a couple mistakes and put it back out there. And then we did a Kickstarter. The goal is $1,000. We ended up going past $1,000 in like less than 24 hours. And then we made a stretch goal to make a new video. And we hit that stretch goal. And then The Force Awakens came out on video a couple months ago, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, that's like the perfect topic to do a new video on. So Star Wars was in this kind of woven into the original story overall, but was also featured in the second part. And I thought, oh, this is like the perfect subject to do a new video about. So I, once I pre-ordered the Blu-ray and got it and, watched a bunch of times and tried to break it down. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this
new video is free,
that's
as
right.
the original ones were.
Yeah.
And so anyone can watch it. We'll link to it. It's very entertaining. It does seem like you've, just the production values alone are better than the original. And
mm-hmm.
it does seem like the
original
is kind of matured.
Yeah, that's good to help.
Yeah, so that movie. I mean, I did a conversation on Blogging Heads about that movie.
I watched that, or I watched the clip you sent me.
Yeah, it is a blatant ripoff of the source material. It's bizarrely,
it is. Yeah,
it goes. I think it goes beyond homage to kind of ripoff status. I think it's a great movie, but they didn't even put a twist in.
I know. Yeah, I know.
what do you think of The Force Awakens? Just as a
movie? I like it. I mean, like most people, I enjoyed it, and it's a little hard to tell at this point because I've studied it, you know, and it becomes different once you study it. Then you start to appreciate technical things about it and stuff, you know. So it's so I think I probably like it more after studying it. When I saw it, I thought it was fine, it was good, you know, and that was kind of it. And that actually probably is more my authentic reaction to the film, is that it was good, it was fine. But I think, like, for me, the major issue was that it just went over the top a bit. Like, I'm okay, I understand what they're trying to accomplish with the film, and I think it could have been derivative to a certain level, a certain moderately high level, pretty comfortably. But then there was stuff like, nobody needs another run in the Death Star, you know? Like, we do not, like, that one in particular is just like, God, do we really? And it's happened twice in the series.
They did it twice already. Yeah. There was three films originally, and they did it twice.
Exactly. They've already trotted it out again. Yeah, so, I mean, that was a terrible runner.
There was an interesting, you know, when that movie came out, there was a ton of writing about it online. And someone, I think it was actually the conservative political writer Ben Dominic, if I'm recalling this correctly, wrote about how there was a real missed opportunity of what they could have had the twist be, oh, they failed. You know, the rebels failed, and then the galaxy was destroyed by the evil guys. And then suddenly you're back at, and then it's at like the end of Empire.
Right.
You know, like a down ending. And then that scrambles everything. So it could have been like Princess Leia and everyone else was vaporized.
Yes.
And then that would have, like, reset the board in a crazy way, but they didn't do that. I think that would have been a much better end.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I found really strange about it was, like, that it being as derivative as it was didn't even make sense in some regards. Like, that they just went back, that you know, Return of the Jedi ended with the rebels triumphing, and that is the universe that everybody's living in for the next 40 years until this film comes out. But somehow we just sort of reset the board so that basically we've got a new empire in place, even though
it doesn't make a ton of sense.
No, it doesn't. And weird stuff like the Jedi are again this like unknown thing, even though, you know, they kind of save the galaxy. You know, within a lifetime of lots of people.
You would think people know what the Jedi are now.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
presumably there was a Jedi Academy. There were all those books that came out. They kind of erased all that non-movie fan lore stuff.
Right.
But why, yeah, so I'll go. So as someone who studied this as like a text, why do you think they did that? Like, there's like J.J. Abrams is smart. He knows how to do a twist. I mean, the TV show Lost is like, you got a different twist every week.
Yeah.
Why did they not do a crazy twist?
At the beginning, to like somewhere in the film.
Well, either at the beginning or at the end, where a crazy twist could have made it so that the next movie would just be totally different.
Right, like it did with Star Trek. You mean kind of, right? I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's actually not that strongly a J.J. Abrams voiced film, really. Like, it doesn't, I don't think it really does his tropes that much. It doesn't do the bull twists. Like, I suspect he had a pretty what's the word for it? I'm trying to modest goal of just like doing a good Star Wars movie. I suspect that was it. And they also wanted to.
But it's not a modest goal because George Lucas.
No, it was. I think it was kind of modest.
Failed three more times.
I personally think it. But he didn't. That's the thing. Like, if you watch those, I watched the prequels again as well, and those films are they're ambitious. They actually are ambitious. Like, they go into very very different realms.
He was trying to do a lot, and
he was. He wasn't trying to just like make a good Star Wars movie. He was trying to. He was going for it. Like, I totally respect that about the prequels. Like, and just technologically, what he was trying to do was ambitious, and it didn't work. But like, he tried, and hats off to him for that. You know, I think that's great. So I think those films lowered the bar for The Force Awakens. So I think the film could have just been not as. And I don't think it's like a great classic movie by any means, but it could have been lower, and it still. I think people still would have loved it. So I think he had the modest goal of making a good.
People
good
came in hungering for something good.
Yes,
and they would have accepted a B+.
Yep.
I think they got more or less an A, you know, movie, and then everyone went nuts about it. It's a very good movie. It could stand alone. If a child had never seen Star Wars and they saw that movie, they'd have a good time.
Absolutely. No question.
And the original movies were made for children, so.
Yes.
But, you know, the fairy tales and everything else, these have, you know, yeah. These are for children, but they have larger life lessons.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect there were a lot of, like, pragmatic concerns at work. I mean, I don't know the story. I mean, publicly we don't know the story of how the film got made, but I suspect there were a lot of pragmatic concerns. Like, we have to hit this, you know, this young demographic. We have to have young characters, you know, we have to, we probably kind of want to set the world up again for those people so that they don't necessarily have to have watched everything before it. I suspect those sorts of forces, just purely pragmatic forces, drove a fair amount of the production of the film.
Well, that's a funny word to use, terms of forces, in terms of Star Wars.
Jesus, I didn't think of it.
I mean, J.J. Abrams used the force or whatever to make a good movie that fits in. But okay, so why do you think they did do another Death Star run? Why couldn't they come up with something different?
I don't know, dude.
Do you have any idea about that?
I don't. I also took a close look at. There's a book called The Art of the Force Awakens that is very good. If people enjoyed the film, or if you're just interested in filmmaking, this book is very interesting. But originally, the artwork for the Death Star, it was more like, and it is kind of different.
I'm sorry, the Star Killer base.
The Star, right. The Star, it is a bit different, right? It is a weapon that's built into a planet. It's not just a giant machine. And in the, so it's like a little bit different, but it's bigger. They made that very clear. So it is a bit different, but it didn't get different enough. And also in the original, it looked like in the original artwork that they had to fly into the base. So instead of going down the trench, like the classic trench that we've done, you know, that was the third time doing it. At least you had to go into a different environment to take the weapon out.
Well, in Jedi, they go into the middle of the thing. And blow
that's
it
right.
Up,
they kind of did. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I guess it wouldn't have been that much different. I think they tried to make it a little different with building it into a planet, and it just ultimately, you know, ended up seeming not different at all once they
so instead of blowing up a thing that's the size of a moon, I mean, look at the size of that.
Yeah. That they went down a trench as well. It was like that moment was just like, God, who needs this? Like, just,
a trench. They had some idea of what they wanted to do, because they could have done something totally different. I honestly have no idea what they were thinking, unless somehow it's going to play into, like, they're playing a long game with this stuff, and maybe somehow it's going to play into stuff that's happening in the sequels.
I doubt it. I think they just trotted it out. Like, it's, you know, it's classic Star Wars.
Well, just like the
cantina. Like, it was just like, let's, you know, it's Star Wars. We gotta do this sort of scene. But anyway, that in particular was, that to me was like the second worst moment in the film. The first worst was definitely the Nazi rally. That was, I thought that was like the most kind of painful moment in the film for me. I just found
remix video, it's a direct lifting of a famous photograph.
The whole setup. Yeah, it's crazy literal. I mean, the stormtroopers even do a Heil Hitler at the end of it. Like, it's crazy literal. Like, it's fine, you know, to draw inspiration from World War II. That's A-okay, but it's just so on the nose literal that it's really weird. And it's so old now. You know, it's such a, like, is that the kind of enemy that resonates with modern viewers?
So in 1979, you know, World War II ended 34 years earlier, if I remember math correctly. But now we are, like, almost 70 years.
Yeah, it's old at this point. It's an important event, but it's very old at this point. And it's not the sort of, do we fear fascists at this point? But I don't think we fear fascists at this point. Like, it's weirdly...
Let's see what comes of this presidential election.
That's right, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, let's just to continue on the Star Wars theme for a little bit longer.
Sure.
You draw an interesting kind of difference between the way that George Lucas borrowed and remixed things and the way that J.J. Abrams is a classic remixer as well. Do you want to talk about how they are different artists in that way?
Yeah, to me, George Lucas was very he actually would mimic shots. Like scenes would play out in the same way. The composition of shots would be similar, placed in similar environments. Like, he could actually look at the two shots which I do a lot of in the second part of Everything is a Remix, and lots of other people have done this sort of thing as well. But you can just look at the shots, and like they look alike, and the scenes play very similar.
There's a shot from The Searchers, that is a 1-to-1 correspondence shot from,
and the cantina scene where in the moment where Obi-Wan slices off the arm of the dude, that whole conflict is very much like a moment in Yojimbo. I think it's Yojimbo. Yeah, it's a Kurosawa film. So he mimics in a fairly direct way where you can look at the two sources and you can see that they're very similar. To me, J.J. Abrams doesn't do that so much. It's not so much. He does do a little bit of it, but it's not really his shtick. To me, it's story elements that Abrams copies. Like, he's very big on remixing different tropes and putting twists on them and merging them together with other well-established genres. But he's a guy who, like, gives you what you want. You know, he gives you what you want and he merges it with other stuff and he puts twists on it, and he's funny and he packs a lot into his stories, and he does a pretty good action scene. You know, like I don't want to underplay how good that he's a genius at doing like popular entertainment. He's, you know, it seems like he's absolutely one of the best right now. He's really good at it.
I'd agree. So he gives people what they want. That's I think that's an apt phrase. That's a great way to make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
You charge people for what they already want.
Yeah.
They will gladly give you their money.
Yeah. Put your little twist on. But the thing is, I think that is a diminishing returns thing. Like, I'm sure at there's some part of him that is like, shit, I did Super 8, which is a Spielberg cover, basically. I've done two Star Trek films. Now I've done The Force Awakens, and I had to do The Force Awakens because the opportunity came up and I had to do it, right? But I'm sure there's some, like, itch in him that, like, wow, I've done a lot of, you know, giving people what they want. I suspect he has an itch to do something different at this point, probably.
Well, I mean, Lost is pretty original.
Lost is kind of old, yeah.
To Survivor, but it was kind of the first, it was the first kind of serial science fiction TV show that was made for grown-ups.
Yep.
I would say.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty...
But he actually stepped away from that very early on.
Yeah, he only did the pilot. Exactly. He was a co-creator. Yeah. So he was definitely established. He contributed significantly. I don't know how much, but like was listed as a co-creator, one of three people.
Yeah, they had a story bible. They weren't making up as they went along. They had a story bible from the beginning.
That's surprising.
They kind of were, you know, it was improv in the jazz sense.
They
kind of knew where they were going, but they originally thought maybe they would get two seasons or something, and then they ended up having like six seasons.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of
time, right.
You know, wasting time in the middle there. But they knew the whole good versus evil, like playing itself out, like all that stuff they had from the beginning.
Right. Yeah, so he was, you know, definitely a strong contributor. But after that first pilot, after that two-part pilot, he was out.
Would you say that Lucas famously borrowed from the mythical classical stories that Joseph Campbell identified having to do with, the orphan hero leaving mm-hmm. the provinces to go to find adventure, and there's an elderly guide who dies, and a friend, and a love interest, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I mean, how do you see Abrams fitting into that kind of mold of making modern myths in the way that Lucas did with Star Wars?
I suspect that he's not much interested in Joseph Campbell's ideas, really. I think he just draws from modern films, basically, and probably doesn't think about it too much, because they are myths. I mean, I'm not even convinced. I don't know if you know more about this than I do, but I'm not sure how much Joseph Campbell influenced George Lucas in the production of the original film. Like, to me, it seems like after that, absolutely, there's no question that he was influenced by Campbell. But for the original film, I don't know. I haven't personally seen that much that is really.
I'm not really sure either. Maybe it was kind of after the fact.
Yeah, because he was drawing from very mythical material. That was his influence. So of course it fit into Campbell's formulas because he was just drawing from mythical stories themselves, the modern Hollywood versions of them.
Yeah.
So I suspect that's how he started, and I suspect Abrams lives in that world. He just watches movies and intuitively.
Yeah, maybe he's never even read a book.
I think that's true. I think I think J.J. Abrams has never read a book. He's a smart dude. J.J. Abrams is unquestionably a smart dude, but he's a movie buff, no doubt about that. And, you know, you can see it in his films for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, if maybe he's like the postmodern like version of this, where the original referent of classic myth that George Lucas used he just goes off of the new myth or something. So it is kind of postmodern in a way that's like very self-referential.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, kind of obscure or obscurantist. I'm just kind of thinking out loud, but
right.
He, you know, his touchstones are George Lucas and Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
Where, you know, and they are still alive.
Yeah.
And still doing stuff.
Right.
So it is kind of postmodern.
And he's worked directly with them as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in some ways he's kind of just people say he's just like a hack or he just copies things. But as you point out, everything is a remix. So let's talk kind of about something I'm interested in is kind of like the economics of the business model that you're kind of pioneering.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a Kickstarter, but the Kickstarter was not to, you know, is the Kickstarter just to pay your bills more or less? Is it to finish a specific project?
No.
Or is it for specific rewards? Like, what is the Kickstarter and what are you aiming to do with the Kickstarter?
It's just another income stream, basically. It wasn't intended to... I didn't start with it intending to make a larger project. Basically, we sell merchandise ongoing, and we try to finance the production of the merchandise instead of having to go out of pocket to make the merchandise. And it also gives you an idea of how interested people are in the particular things that you're selling. So that's the main motive. And that's what the rewards are. That's what the goals are that we set. It's like the first one was, you know, we want to hit $1,000 was the goal for the first one, just to make a little bundle of t-shirts. And this one, we went a little higher. We went with 5,000. So that's the main goal, is just to sell some shirts. We make a profit off the shirts, of course, but it's not, you know, life-changing sort of money. It's just another sort of income stream. And then we had a stretch goal with this one, which it looks like we probably won't make, to make another video. If we could hit 20K, we could make another remix video in the near future. Not like ever. It's not like it will never happen if we don't hit that goal. But it looks like we probably won't get it for this particular Kickstarter, and that's totally fine. It'll be fun to make some more shirts, and I'm also writing a little book about using remix techniques in creative work, like a really short little book that I'm selling that is a reward in the Kickstarter as well. So basically, it's just another income stream, and it's not really. I don't think of it as a living or you know, paying for, you know, the next few months of my life or whatever. It's just another thing to add. And that's what indie life is. It's, you know, taking a bunch of stuff and patchworking a living out of it.
Yeah. So so when you first started releasing these, was this just a passion project, something you're interested
Absolutely.
In? Did you think that eventually this could somehow lead to a revenue stream?
No.
Or something you would have just done because you wanted to do it for fun?
Yeah, I wanted to do it for fun. I mean, I certainly had, you know, there were ideas in my mind about, like, you know, boy, it'd be great to make a living doing this sort of stuff. But I definitely didn't start it with that intention.
And what were you doing as a day job when you made the original videos?
I was a video producer. So I was... I was working at doing like interviews and behind the scenes shoots about photography shoots. So it was a fun job, you know, it was okay. And I started Everything Is Remix in my free time. And then that's, you know, it's just generated a lot of interest really quickly. And, you know, various things started happening that I didn't anticipate happening, like getting speaking engagements. I was like, oh, like I've never spoken before and people want me to go speak. Like, oh, okay, I guess I'll try that, sure. And like, you know, some commissions would come up here and there, sponsorships, sold merchandise a little bit, took donations, actually did fairly well with donations for the first episode. So I just suddenly realized, like, oh, like that, you know, you can make some amount of money at this anyway. And then I ended up quitting the day job, and, you know, I've been independent for about 5 years now.
I mean, it's great. I think that's what a lot of people in this world want to do is
yeah, it's tough.
Pursue their interests, and instead of punching the clock. Yeah, so how... Okay, so how tough is it? I mean...
It's crazy tough. It's insanely tough. I mean, it's...
Going without essentials, or...
No.
Have there been times where you're ready to get another 9-to-5 job?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I honestly, like, right now, I'm probably going to make some sort of switch and do contract work for a bit, or maybe get a job for a bit. Like, I just, basically, I don't see myself, like, the idea isn't I'm just going to stop altogether, but, you know, just take a break from it, because it's crazy stressful. Like, you never know where money is coming from at any right. point in time. If you can figure out something where you can get some solid things that finance you regularly every month, that's definitely the way to go. And I had some stuff like that, but it just generates kind of a sub part-time sort of income. It's not, anything like a full-time income. So
right.
it's a ton of stress. It's crazy, crazy stressful. You work a lot. That doesn't bother you so much because it's your own work and it's fun, but super tough. It's really stressful. It's really rewarding. The highs are higher than you know, doing a job, but the lows are lower as well. Like when you're working a day job, and if you're doing, you know, good work, you know it's not you know, you're not living your dream or whatever, but you're getting to do good work and you're working with nice people or whatever, then that's, you know, that's a good life. You know, people shouldn't underrate that life. And it's stable, you know, or it has the illusion of stability. At least you can get fired at any point, but it feels pretty stable. Whereas that rug is pulled out from under you doing indie work. Like, there's no illusions about stability. You have to go out there and find work. So it's super tough. It's not for everybody. And it can definitely burn people out. And right now I'm feeling fairly burned out. And honestly, I could use a little break from it.
Yeah. So what, if you don't want to, if this is getting too personal,
sure.
What you can decline, what opportunities are there out there for someone like you who's clearly has a lot of independent creative energy, but, you know, would, I'm sure, enjoy health insurance.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I could...
What kind of things are you looking for?
Oh, I mean, I could work as a video producer, or I could teach. You know, I've done lots of talks over the years. You know, I could be a good teacher. I'm also open to, like, doing residencies or various contracts or stuff like that. So I don't have my mind made up, but that's the sort of stuff. But video, being a producer of some sort is the most obvious choice. That's the thing I'm most skilled at. But teaching, I would definitely be interested in looking into teaching more. It's newer to me. Like, I don't have a lot of experience doing it. I've done some workshops and stuff, and I've done a lot of public speaking, but I haven't been a teacher. But I'd like to try that. You know, I'm getting older, and, you know, as you get older, you know, you like sharing what you know, you do get wiser. I've experienced that. But like sharing your knowledge with younger people becomes a thing. You know, it's just, I didn't really expect it, but it's a thing that happens, and I've got that now.
Yeah.
So I think I would enjoy that as well.
Yeah, you're probably a little bit older than I am, but I kind of see that in my own life as well, that you do kind of learn stuff as time goes on and you want to share it.
I should hope so.
With the young ones who are coming up, so they don't make.
Yeah, especially once you get like I'm in my 40s now, and you know, I don't feel there's a while there, like maybe in your early 30s or whatever, where you kind of maybe feel competitive with the younger people who are coming up. Once you're officially middle aged, you no longer feel competitive with the younger people. You just want to help out, I think, and that's kind of the stage that I'm in.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so why don't we talk about this other project? Called This Is Not a Conspiracy Theory.
Yes.
I believe we'll link to this original conversation you had with Robert Wright on Blogging Heads TV in 2010 or 11. I believe you were just kind of mentioning this as like your project you were starting to work on.
Yeah.
And it was a Kickstarter that I backed. Was it Kickstarter in 2012?
That's right. 2012, yeah.
Okay, well, what the hell, man?
I didn't know I was going to take shit on this show.
No, but I'm not mad. I'm not mad.
Good.
But no, it's just like this is clearly the project took directions that you did not anticipate.
Yes, absolutely.
So
there's a lot to be learned from this.
About
actually.
This project and
yeah.
Like, what is happening with it?
Basically, it's just super slow and taking a long time. Basically, that's the short answer. And I'm actually, the fourth episode is about to come out. Not about to come out. I'm working on it. Like,
okay.
I don't say anything's coming out.
Don't
like, right now. Yeah. In the near future, I'll say that.
Okay.
So I'm working on that next. So when the fourth part comes out, it will be, there'll be about an hour of finished footage that I produce. So that it's getting substantial at that point. But basically it's just something that like, I wasn't really, I kickstarted it too early. I kickstarted in 2012, and it took me 2 years to like develop the premise and to feel confident about deploying the thing and starting it and knowing that I can pay off, you know, what I said I was going to do. And just finding like a catchy premise for it and everything, like that takes a long time. Like for Remix, that took, I wasn't on the clock, but it was brewing around for a couple of years or something. It's not like I was working on it full time, but like it was bouncing around my head, and you just need time to develop these things. So it took a long time to get it off the ground. There were various personal travails as well that you know, slowed things down for sure. So it was a troubled launch for sure. But basically, I kickstarted it too early. I should have kickstarted it 2 years later. I launched the first episode of the video. That's when I should have launched the Kickstarter.
Yeah,
so, okay. So that's the mistake I made. I launched it when I didn't completely know what it was.
Okay,
so,
but you must have had, has your core idea changed from what originally was? I mean, the title hasn't changed.
No, I mean, I never said what it was in the original. If you watch the original Kickstarter video, I don't actually say what it is. It's very vague, which you should do. If you're starting from zero, you want to be very vague. So no, I didn't say what it was. So it developed, it did change. It became bigger. It became bigger and more ambitious. And, you know, that was my fault. Like I just didn't understand how long it was going to take. And I wanted to do something really hard. Like I wanted to push myself as far as I could push myself. I thought, you know, I'm growing as an artist. I've still got the energy to do this, to push and, you know, try to, you know, make it the absolute best that I can make it. So that was my guiding principle throughout the whole thing, was just make it really good. And the timeline, I do pay attention to timelines. Like I'm not oblivious to time. But at the same time, if I put it out early, if I put it out like on schedule and it stinks, that accomplishes jack squat. That accomplishes nothing. So it's got to hit a certain standard. And then I've got to make money. Like, it got it started, but then it became big and it didn't get done within the amount of time that it originally financed. So then after that, you have to take on various projects to make money. And now it's sort of a juggling act of like finding time to do it at this point. But so there's still probably two more years left in it is the honest truth. But
they're going to kick you off Kickstarter.
There's way worse than me. There's way worse than me. I'm just slow. I mean, it will get done, but
are you a perfectionist? You kind of seem like a perfectionist.
No, not really. A little bit. Yeah. There's lots of stuff in the videos that, especially visually, that I don't think are that great. So no, absolutely not.
A perfectionist to a standard that maybe the average person isn't a perfectionist to? Like, you notice the one little niggling error.
Oh, sure.
That other people don't notice.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some degree of that. I have a high standard. I'll say that. But I don't, like, I think of as a perfectionist, somebody who will just, like, polish and polish and polish and never finish the goddamn thing. Like, I definitely, you know, do get it done.
Kirby, I mean.
Well, the installments, you know, they do get it done.
No, you are producing.
I'm not making a movie.
To Barbados, you know, islands. And,
yeah.
Sipping a Mai Tai or something, like you, it's clearly you're working on it. Okay, can you reveal anything more about where it is heading? It still seems, the ones that I've watched, it still seems somewhat preparatory.
Yep.
And I think I know what your thesis is, but I'm not exactly sure. Do you know what your thesis is at this point?
Yeah, I mean, the thesis is in the very first video. It's about how people, I don't believe that there's anybody out there that is controlling the future. Or that's my hypothesis, is that there's nobody out there that is controlling the future. And then the video, like, I'm going to keep this really short and simple for the audience, but like the video is an exploration of that. How people don't plan the future, that the future emerges out of what I'm loosely calling systems at the moment. So technologies, laws, cultural norms, like things that function as rules, and this is tough stuff to explain quickly, but the point of the series is to accessibly get these stories across. So that's the point of it. The point is that certainly people do conspire, certainly, you know, various conspiracies actually did happen, and people want to conspire, but I don't think they're what shapes the future. So it's sort of an anti-conspiracy theory project.
Right. I assume you have read Robert Wright's book, Non-Zero.
I've not read Non-Zero yet. No, I haven't.
Well,
why is does it relate in some? How does it relate?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's called The Logic of Human Destiny is the subtitle. And yep. It's about game theory and technological evolution and whether or not kind of like human, there's some sort of intelligent life on planet Earth was inevitable, and it goes along with that. I mean, you should add it to the list.
Yeah, I actually own the book, but I just, it hasn't seen it quite. Yeah.
No, it sounds kind of similar to what you're saying. So what I've inferred is kind of like, and what you've kind of said is that, you know, there's no Bilderberg group. It's not like the Vanderbilts.
No, there is a Bilderberg group, actually.
Well, no, I mean, there is, yeah. There is, but they don't do anything really to, they don't shape human history.
They probably don't, no.
Do you think that there is, I mean, is it like you can kind of tell what's going to happen if you know what's everyone's, all the players are and what their interests are? Is it that kind of thing? Or like, it's just that
history
happens and there's no hidden hand. It just kind of unfolds along its own logic.
Well, I think what I want to get across is how things that are not people influence history, like technology produces culture. It produces events that affect people in personal ways, but it's created by this, like, seemingly this thing that doesn't have any morality. It doesn't have any ideology. So like technology is a good example, but there are various laws, regulations, like defining its systems is what I'm talking about. And defining systems is part of the agenda of the series. So basically systems are rules and they create, to me, that is what guides the future. It is systems, it is rules, it is not people's various plots. Because systems and rules are what mold our decisions every single day. Like constantly every decision we make, they're guided by these rules. So to me, if you want change, the systems are what you should look at. The systems and who defines the systems. That to me is where energy should be directed and not towards.
Is it don't hate the player, hate the game?
Or criticize the game at least. Yeah, criticize the rules. Yeah, that's pretty good. I might use that. That's pretty good. That's pretty
well,
good because this is hard shit to explain. You suggested.
I borrowed it from somewhere. Somewhere
right,
else.
You remixed.
Is it kind of like what's sometimes called vulgar Marxism or economic determinism? Would you say
I don't know what those are.
Those lines.
I don't know what those are. Vulgar Marxism.
Yeah. Well, you should Google it. It's kind of like saying that Marx was half right.
Right.
And he was right about the fact that economic interests determine most human action.
Mm-hmm.
What he was wrong about was that there's going to be a revolution of the proletariat.
Right, yes. Because that's a theory.
So he was wrong about that. That was kind of a big oops.
Yes. I don't have a theory. I'll say that, too.
Okay. Well, he was kind of... I kind of believe in economic determinism in that, you know, people act in their own interests,
yes.
And it's usually a monetary interest, but not always. But the great ideas and kind of like, they come and go. And what you're saying kind of sounds like the opposite of the great man theory of history to me.
Yes.
And so the economic determinism is kind of like, you know, Donald Trump is doing something.
Mm-hmm.
He is not at the vanguard of a great movement. He's just doing what he's doing to get attention and money, in my opinion. And that's kind of what everyone is doing, things that they think promote their own self-interest at all times, unless they are like literally insane.
Right.
And even then, the person who's like schizophrenic and screaming in the street, in his or her mind, it makes sense to do what they're doing.
Yeah. I doubt that I would subscribe to that theory myself, because number one, it's a theory. Like, I don't think any sort of, if you want to predict human behavior, like, good fucking luck, man. Like, good luck with that. Have fun. If you start logging your results, and most of us, we go through our lives having these theories. I mean, this is another thing the series is about. You know, we all go through life recognizing patterns and creating little theories to explain the patterns. And then we recognize our hits and we don't recognize our misses. We recognize all the times that are things. So it's confirmation bias. But if you start logging, if you start collecting data, you will see that you are a miserable failure at a theorist, I'm sure.
Certainly. And there are some people who are notoriously bad at this, like the political analyst, Bill Kristol.
Right.
Is notoriously wrong about almost everything. He continues to make predictions and continues to be wrong every single time, but somehow he has no shame and he is not dissuaded.
It's amazing. I mean, you can be a seriously intelligent person and just make really, really wrong predictions. Predictions about human history are, they're beyond any of us. Like, nobody can predict the future. If you happen to get the future right, it is luck, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous saying that predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Yoga Vera, is that?
I don't. It sounds like
who is that?
Yeah, might be some economist or something.
Right.
I don't know who said that. It wasn't me originally.
I think it's Yogi.
There's also. I mean, do you have any opinion on like Nate Silver?
Not really. No, I haven't researched him much. I only have like passing familiarity with his stuff. It seems like his electoral predictions are quite accurate, right?
Well, here's the thing. He came to prominence. He was a little bit like you. He was a guy who had a day job, I think, as a data analyst at like a stock company or a financial firm or something.
Mm-hmm.
Under a pseudonym, he started blogging at Daily Coast in 2008 and started predicting who was going to win the various Democratic primary and caucuses between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Right.
And he was doing very well, doing better than the kind of people who appear on TV on Sunday morning. And so he got more and more of a following. He started his own website called 538. And then he moved to the New York Times. And he was very successful in 2008 and 2012.
Yeah.
In 2016, he has been much less successful.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Actually.
So
okay.
He discounted Trump from the beginning and continued discounting Trump over and over and over again.
Wow.
Trump started winning and he kept on saying, this is a bubble. This isn't going to last. It can't last. This has never happened before. Well, he eventually had to write a mea culpa because it became so embarrassing.
Right.
That he was just getting it. He got it wrong. And it's, you know, it's in all the public record.
Yeah.
He didn't like wipe the web pages away. Okay. Nate Silver thought he could predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
We have all learned that he can't.
Right.
So if he still worked for the New York Times, they might have fired him by now.
Right.
Because he was the guy who was supposed to be able to look at the data and tell you what was most likely to happen. And he got it very wrong. But he's
right.
The boss now, so he's not going to get fired.
Right.
In the same way that Bill Kristol is the editor of the Weekly Standard, so he can't lose his job.
Right.
Because he's the boss.
Right.
But Nate Silver has really lost his luster in this election.
Right.
And it kind of shows that, like, yeah, the future is weird. You cannot actually predict it.
Yeah. I mean, and it shows how, like, it must be, these predictions must be guided by our temperaments to a great degree, you know? Like, why does he... Probably, like, an influence on why he thought Trump could not win is that that is his outlook on the world. Like, this guy cannot possibly win. Like, that's probably, I know he's working with data, but, you know,
he's
calculating
that.
Yeah,
that's who he is. He's a statistician.
Right.
He looks at the numbers. Okay, that
right.
tells you some things in life, but
right.
it doesn't tell you everything, or probably doesn't even tell you one third of what's actually happening in life.
I'd be curious how he got it so wrong, actually, just using data.
Well, what's happening this year in national politics literally is without precedent in American history.
Right.
The last person to get a major party presidential nomination who has no previous electoral office was Dwight Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he did some good things in his life. He defeated Hitler. Donald Trump has owned a lot of casinos and gone bankrupt a lot.
Right.
So it's weird. What's happening this year is weird. I have my own theories. But... it's very weird. So, okay, if you think... Here's how... I've tried to put this in a pithy way on Twitter. No one's really seemed to care, but the biggest error that political pundits make is thinking, A, if something has never happened before, it cannot happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then B, if something is happening now, it will continue happening forever.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's all you can do with data, right? You can't predict... you know, emergent events that are based on very complex feedback interactions that produce some sort of giant spike in whatever. Like, people can't see these things coming.
Yeah, I mean, there's maybe a couple people out there in the world, like Warren Buffett or something, who really can kind of see this stuff coming, but they become billionaires by playing the stock market.
Yeah, and I bet they're wrong sometimes, too. Like, I bet sometimes they think it's coming and it doesn't or whatever. Like, there is some sort of failure ratio at
work
as well.
Yeah, there's no true oracles out there who
yeah.
really see the future.
So basically, when unprecedented things happen, models can't account for that. Models are based on what does happen. So, you know, of course it makes sense that you would be wrong about this. But that's human behavior. Like, every once in a while, weird events happen that are unprecedented, and you know, you can't use data to predict these things.
Yeah, I'm sure it's funny that Silver came to prominence in 2008. You know, he worked for either a financial firm or some kind of forecasting company. You know, he was not one of the people in the movie The Big Short. You know,
right.
There are people who saw that the housing bust was coming and they bet against it and they made like literally $1 billion.
Sure. Yeah.
But there weren't that many of those people.
Right.
And they could have been wrong. But
right.
It turns out that like 98% of the people in America thought housing would continue growing indefinitely, and 2% did not.
Right.
And not a lot of people saw it coming, even though it was, in hindsight, you know, it was kind of obvious that this whole thing was like built on sand, sometimes literally.
But I wonder like how many knew how big it was going to be as well. Like,
yeah,
yes, they knew that a crash was coming in housing, but did they know a giant recession
was
coming? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So weird shit happens, and America's a weird country, you know, every single day. Sadly, this past weekend, there was the worst single mass casualty shooting in American history. And that's happening when crime is lower than it's been since like the 50s.
Yeah.
So this is a crazy. Humans are weird, and America is weird. So
yeah,
weird shit happens every single day.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, tiny people can achieve large scale effects at this point too.
So,
like,
you know,
who
this guy who shot,
you can do some research. Yeah, you can do some research on the internet. Yeah,
like,
or mentally ill. It appears like he could be mentally ill. It's very early in this story. Like, for future people watching this, we don't quite know what's going on.
This guy's not a mastermind. He just got a gun.
But with Google, man, like, I'm sure you can find out tactical things. I'm sure you can find out plenty of things about, you know, having your gun, you know, using the best gun that is not going to jam on you. And you can, you know, get a lot of shots off, you know, various tactics. I'm sure you looked into... I believe he looked into body armor. You know, there's a lot that you can achieve just Googling. A single person who might just be mentally ill, you know, like there might not be malice behind it. They're mentally ill. You know, they can achieve enormous things nowadays.
Yeah. And, you know, the person who assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah.
In 1914.
Start World War I, yeah.
Prinkip or Prinship, he started a war that killed, you know, 60 million people, he was just essentially a loser.
But that's the thing is, I think that takes enormous luck. That's like killing JFK, right? Like, I get into JFK a bit, and this is not a conspiracy theory. And
well, okay, well, that's a good question. Who do you think killed JFK?
Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK. Yeah, I'm sorry to get
that makes sense to me.
I don't give a shit who killed JFK, honestly. Like, I don't have a horse in the game. Like, I don't have my mind made up, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not strongly anti-American. Like, I don't like the thought, I'm not attracted to the thought that the government did it. You know, I don't have my mind. I don't have an ideological position. If the government did it, if the CIA did it, if the mafia did it, whatever, I'm open to all those possibilities.
No axe to grind.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm fairly. I think I'm fairly impartial going in, but I just don't see the. I have biases like everybody, but I don't see the evidence that. Like, why do we need more than just that? This guy who worked at the book depository, where the president was driving by in the middle of the day, who was a very good shot. We know that he was a very good shot. He shot multiple times. You know, and none of the shots were like textbook kill shots. You know, he missed. What was it? He missed once. The second shot was not fatal, and the third shot, if it was a couple inches over, probably would have missed as well. And just that they happened to be driving in an open car that day, that JFK was wearing a back brace at the time, right? He had a very bad back, and after the first hit did not slump over, which probably would have happened if he wasn't wearing that. I mean, this is not definite, but you know, some people believe this, that the back brace kept him upright even after he'd already been shot. Like John Connolly, after he gets shot, he slumps over.
Yeah.
I don't see why. And there's been all sorts of computer simulations and stuff that have happened since then that show us that single bullet creating the seven wounds that it created, you know, is totally, totally possible. It's not probable, but it's possible. And shooting from that angle with all those variables being what they were, it is logical that he achieved all those wounds with that single shot. And it seems very logical that Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK by himself. But anyway, it took a lot of luck, right? And a lot of various things being just so for that to happen. I believe it used to take a lot of luck to achieve something like that. But now you can do some Googling and you can, you know, defense can't be perfect all the time in the world. Like there's some place that you can go where you can create some serious mayhem.
Yeah. I mean, if we look back to 9/11, if they had either had slightly better metal detectors or had had locks on the cockpit doors,
yeah,
well, then the history of the past 15 years would be very different.
Yeah. Which is an amazing thought. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, history is weird. It doesn't follow a real logic, or weird things happen. And I guess the point of this is not a conspiracy theory, as I take it, is that we feel the need to build a story around these facts and think that there's someone, you know, Wizard of Oz style behind the curtain,
yeah,
controlling things. But really, it's just the semi-randomness of human existence.
Yeah, it's a comforting idea, I think, even though you're imagining a seriously powerful and secretive, brilliant, evil villain. That's what a conspiratorial person imagines. You know, it's a person who's just sort of not subject to the influences that the rest of us are subject to. They get to make the rules themselves. They're the puppet masters.
Yeah.
Even though you're imagining this terrible figure, there's something comforting about that, you know, that there is somebody out there.
I agree with that a lot. I think that's very true, that the conspiracy theorist wants to think there is a hidden hand. They want to think it's the Jews, or the Rothschilds, or the Bilderbergs. You know what I mean?
Oh, I thought you were going to stick with Jews
it's
there.
More
okay.
comforting to
yeah,
think,
right.
Oh, it's the Jews.
Yes.
Than to
yeah.
think, oh, it's
the Jews were in that building. The Jews came out of the building
I'm from New Jersey.
Yes.
The person who said that most famously was Amiri Baraka, who was a radical black poet who was the poet laureate of the state of New Jersey roughly then. He wrote a poem that was like one of the lines of something like, why did all the Jews leave the World Trade Center on 9/11?
Right.
Okay,
and
well,
he got that.
That's
he
not
got
true
that
that's
from...
anti-Semitism.
Right.
Plenty of people out there who think that the Jews have.
Oh yeah, man.
Really
oh yeah, I've heard that from. Yeah, I've heard that from numerous places, and people won't mention it as in, you know, I think this, but it's just this thing that I heard, you know. And it's amazing that it passes the bullshit filter that most people have. Like, really, like somebody like Jewish Central Control put the bat signal. Up and you know they all left the building before. And
yeah.
Also, you can just go see who you can easily find out who died on 9/11. And there's lots of Jewish names in there. Like it doesn't even like it.
Well,
it,
maybe
it,
those are false flags. I mean,
yes.
What do you think about the fact that
there's always
that,
a way out with a conspiracy theory too? That's,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
The
there's always
thing.
Another
yeah.
explanation.
Yeah.
What do you think about the fact that the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party is a conspiracy theorist himself?
Scary as shit, man. Oh my God, it's scary. It's scary. It's scary, weird times that we are living in right now, man. I mean, like 9/11, that era of torture and beheadings and a never-ending war, like that was a scary, weird time. Like, especially in the period right after 9/11, it was like, wow, like, where are we going? Like, what is going to happen now?
Yeah.
And this election has a bit of that, you know, like, Trump as president is definitely a frightening, alarming idea. You know,
do you think that, you know, he goes on the Alex Jones show. Alex Jones is probably the most famous conspiracy theorist in America.
Yeah, sure.
Trump appears on his show. You know, Glenn Beck goes on that show as well. Do you think that it's helping Trump that he's, I mean, he had this whole conspiracy theory about Obama faking his birth
sure,
certificate
yeah.
and not being kind of a Manchurian candidate. Do you think
yeah.
that this is, like, Trump is kind of the first national politician to exploit this kind of conspiracy thinking since I don't know what, like the Know Nothing Party or something.
Right.
Like, what, yeah, do you think this helps him that he is a conspiracy theorist, especially in the GOP?
I'm not sure he has. I don't know what's coming out of his mouth. So I'm not sure he knows.
I'm not sure he knows.
Because he's just retweeting these things and like, I heard this and whatever. To me, it seems a little bit more like when you hear, you know, from an acquaintance or something, they'll bring up some sort of conspiratorial type thing as in this way of like, I heard, or like, I'm not saying, like, I'm not committing to this, but this is a thing that's out there.
He's like America's uncle posting on Facebook.
Right. Yes.
You know, sending emails around, except he's, you know, getting the, you know, the Secret Service briefings pretty soon.
I'm not sure how committed he is to it as an ideology. It feels like he just wants to bring up a stink generally and impugn various people. So I feel like that's kind of his main agenda. But I just don't know. I'm not convinced that he takes these things that seriously, really. I'm not convinced that much that comes out of his mouth is that serious often, you know?
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
But it's definitely scary times right now.
I have my own hobby horse. And since you are into conspiracy theories, I might as well run it by you.
Perhaps yes, please
do. Listeners are thinking I should be ready to be sent off to the mental ward.
Okay.
But I kind of think that Trump is... He did not get into this thing to win. In fact, I think that's a pretty well-established fact that he thought this would... He wanted to get second place. There's a former communications aide to Trump wrote an essay about this. She quit in protest once she realized what was happening. Okay, I don't think he wants to win. I think he's trying to lose. I mean, JFK, he said on the eve of the Indiana caucus that Ted Cruz's father was involved in the assassination of JFK.
Yeah.
Okay, that's maybe the craziest thing anyone has said in national politics ever. I don't know. And then he won the next day. So I think this is essentially like the movie The Producers,
right,
which he's desperately trying to lose and somehow keeps succeeding because the conservative base and the GOP primary electorate is so kind of fucked in their own way.
Yeah.
They just eat this shit up. Or I think he's desperately trying every day to get out of this thing. That's my conspiracy theory.
That's I find it hard to believe that there's a higher game like that, like, that there is a strategy.
You think he's just improvising every single day?
I do. I honestly do. Yeah, that's what it feels like to me. But it's definitely not the craziest conspiracy theory I've heard, that's for sure.
No, this
it's
is one of the more credible. It's one of the more credible. It's a conspiracy of one person.
Yes, I get. Yes, maybe his immediate people would know, but
maybe I don't know. He pays them. He did not hire
somebody. Would have to know. He's not managing everything on his own.
Well,
there'd have to be a conspiracy.
He does his own Twitter feed like in the evening.
Does he really? He personally
said is that during the day he'll just yell it out, and one of the girls in the office will type it up for him. Whatever the hell that
really
means. And then at night it's like Trump after dark. It's just him on his phone.
He's actually typing them up.
Yes, that's what he says. At least
wow.
It's impossible to know what comes out of his mouth is true.
They definitely look like it. They definitely look like it.
There's typos, weird capitalization.
Yeah.
He has his own syntax
and the actual content of the messages
as well.
It seems like if there was anybody else involved, they might be like, "Hey, maybe let's talk about this tomorrow."
And to continue, that's another part of my kind of conspiracy theory. He has not reined it in the way that someone who actually wanted to become president would rein it in and try to, like, appear not like a crazy person.
Right.
He's just going whole hog. He's living his truth. He's doing him, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's weird. And it's amazing that it's working. I tend to think it's going to blow up in his face at this point.
I do as well.
Yeah, I actually, rationally, I also, like, emotionally, need to believe that, but also like rationally, I think you actually nobody wants a president, or not enough people want a president that is that loony.
So I
think the party ends here. And if it's a huge failure, if this election is a huge failure, then I see that culturally as a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, not even 50% of the GOP primary electorate really wanted him. He only won around 40% of the total.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, roughly 12% of Americans want him at this point, so that means 88% don't, or something like that.
The problem is that Hillary Clinton is also very unpopular as well, so that's the thing that concerns me.
She has really landed in the catbird seat of lucking out that her, you know, no
He's less
Biden
popular
didn't run against her, or Elizabeth Warren didn't run against her, and then, shockingly, the host of TV's The Apprentice is poised to become her opponent for the general election of the United States, presidency of the United States. It's very strange.
She's set up pretty well, it seems like, to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, we're probably about
so
to
let's end on
time.
That. Let's end on that, and then later on, people can excerpt this and be like, look at the tragic things that people thought, before the era of Trump.
Oh man, yeah, it's just like
they thought it was just gonna.
We were thinking on the eve of World War One, they'd be like, the last six weeks.
Yeah, but before the Depression, they're like, man, my stock portfolio is just booming. Oh, life is good.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe Ken Burns III or something will
exactly yeah.
as a way to. Indicate how deluded we all were.
Right.
Or maybe not. Who knows? Okay, so Kirby Ferguson, thanks for coming on. So you're the Kickstarter to get kind of gear and paraphernalia and other things associated with everything is a remix. We'll include the link to that. It ends Friday evening, so the date of Friday evening is the 17th of June. So if you want to get a cool T-shirt or something like that, or support an independent artist who's doing very interesting things. Check it out. The link will be below. Anything else you want to promote? Or, I mean, your Twitter feed is Remix Everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can check out This Is Not a Conspiracy Theory at thisisnotaconspiracytheory.com. And I'm working on the fourth episode of that. And that will be out in the near future. And it's crazy exciting. And I think it's,
the near future.
My best stuff. The near future. That's a phrase I'm going to stick to. But I'm very excited.
Okay.
Before
the Trump. I joke on Twitter, the Trump war.
It'd be in the era. Right, yeah. But I'm very excited about it. I think it's some of my best stuff thus far. And I think the project is really paying off at this point. Like, I've set up interesting things and now I get to pay them off. And cool. I think it's super exciting.
Cool. Well, I already subscribed. But just so people can understand,
you
don't have to have subscribed to the original Kickstarter to get this.
Yeah, no, you can buy it for $15 and then you get, it's a documentary that's released in installments. So when you pay the $15, you get the whole thing and an edit of the whole thing merged
You were kind
together.
Of doing Serial before Serial, in a way.
I was.
But
yeah.
on a much...
I should have trademarked it.
Yeah, but I mean, they were doing it... they spent a year doing all the research, and then they doled it out week by week. You're kind of doing the research and the production at the same
time.
Yeah,
well, I mean, that's how I did Everything's Remix. Like, I love to be able to... put something out there and get a response, right? Like, because my audience is collectively they're way more smarter than I am. So I get to make use of the wisdom of the crowd and you can pivot and you can find out things that you wouldn't have found out otherwise, rather than, because with each branch of your argument that you're following, you could be going further and further into the weeds. You could be more and more wrong because you got something wrong way back at the beginning or whatever. So creating it piece by piece lets you, feel more confident about the story that you're telling and find out things that you just couldn't find out otherwise and incorporate audience feedback into the project. And to me, it makes it more factually sound and more interesting and fun.
Yeah, everyone should check it out. I mean, it just really is kind of a 21st century project in all ways. And, this wouldn't have been possible at all, 10 years ago.
Nope.
You're an innovator, and it's exciting to, see what's happening. I don't know if you listen to the musical Hamilton. There's a line, how lucky we are to be alive right now.
Can you hear Hamilton without going to the
soundtrack? Yes, you can get the soundtrack, almost the entire thing is on YouTube.
Okay.
You can even stream it as a, like a.
Can you watch it?
Place.
You can't watch it though. Right?
You can't watch it, but you
right.
can hear it, and
right.
so that I've not seen it on Broadway, but I'm a fan of the cast album. Yeah, there's a line, "How lucky we are to be alive right now." They say it during the Revolutionary War, but this is an exciting time to be to be alive.
Absolutely.
In many ways.
No question.
A scary time in many ways. But
on the eve of
time.
Trump, we are on the eve of the Trump era. It's a very exciting time.
The pre-Trump. Yeah, this is the BT before Trump. So let's see how it happens. But everyone, thanks, Kirby, for coming on.
Hey, my pleasure.
Everyone should check out the Kickstarter. And this is not a conspiracy theory. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, and thanks to our viewers, and see you again next time.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.